Welcome to Cognis Education Untapped podcast, the show where we bring you experts and leading practitioners in the field of education.
Welcome to the Cognis Education Untapped podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Duffus. This week's episode is coming to you from the Sutton Autism Service. On today's episode, we will be discussing all things autism and inclusion. Our guest today is a specialist in neurological diversity and behaviour and provides support for professionals, parents and young people with autism, ADHD, dyslexia and other areas of neurodiversity. He has a number of roles, including offering support to staff in schools, training both in person and now virtually, and is a genuinely really nice guy. My guest is the fabulous Andrew Whitehouse. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, fabulous Rebecca Duffus. That's brilliant to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
So, that's great.
Did you like the description of you there?
Yeah. It was, you missed a bit out. I do a lot of conferences as well.
Yes.
And, no, I'm not being critical, but I do a lot of conferences as well. And it's, and I like the conferences because you get a lot of free cake. Always speak at conferences. They don't pay you, but you get plenty of cake.
Yeah, or nice buffet lunch is the other alternative.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask if there's anything else that you wanted to add about the work you do.
I don't think so, really. I mean, I find it very difficult when people say, "What do you do?" Because my job encompasses so many different areas, and it grew. In it's been very organic that I cover so many roles. It's quite unbelievable, really. I mean, when I started, I literally just used to run autism day courses, and then it grew and grew and grew. But some of the things that I get called in for, on the surface of it, I'm not really qualified to do. So, for example, I'll put your mind at rest with that one. But something like a school will call me in to spend a few days looking at behaviour. Well, I'm not a behaviour specialist, but if you're an autism specialist and you're an ADHD specialist and PDA, you've got a really good idea, as you know, about how behaviour works.
Yeah.
So that's kind of an interesting thing. Like I say, I do conferences, and I remember speaking to a friend of mine who works in academia and line manages academics, and I said, "Oh, what should my conference profile be for a year?" And they said, "Oh, two, but we prefer three." And I was, "Okay, well, I've done 43 over the last 2 years." So, it's a busy world, that's for sure.
Wow, really busy. And that's a really good point about behaviour, because I think sometimes people think of behaviour as a kind of separate thing from the child almost.
That
actually, you know, behaviour is everything that we do and say. We all behave all the time. It's just that.
That's right.
You know, there's often an underlying cause for why you might be behaving in a certain way, perhaps.
Sure. And I mean, what they actually mean is challenging behaviour. And then, even then, challenging behaviour, you know, be honest, I'll be honest with myself. How many times in a day do you present me challenging behaviour? You know, I mean, I'm proper grumpy old man, really. But what you've got to do, you know, I mean, If I'm on a phone call, say a head teacher or a Senko, somebody phones me up, so we've got a child presenting me challenging behaviour. And I say, "Well, what is the challenging behaviour?" They say, "Well, you know, they're just very naughty." And then I say, "Yeah, but I want to know what." And you could find that a child is presenting with 100 different types of challenging behaviour. And then within that, you think, well, and this is, I think, where a lot of people make the mistake. Okay, well, we'll deal with those 100 things. I said, no, let's just choose three presentations, low-level ones, and work on those. And, you know, it's like in relationships, you know, if you try and change an entire person, you're probably going to split up, you know. But if you just kind of work together on two or three things, then you're going to have success. And I think, you know, with children, working with children in a school, that's a relationship, and that's where you have to choose your priorities carefully and collaboratively.
Yeah, definitely. And the whole challenging behaviour as well. I know I read something the other day that was talking about challenging behaviour from therapists, from teachers. And actually, sometimes it's, you know, we may well be the ones that are challenging.
Like
you said, being grumpy or, you know, whatever it is, we all have our own displays, don't we?
Oh, good grief, yeah. And that's interesting as well, because, well, on two levels there. First of all, if people ask me to deliver training on challenging behaviour, I won't do that because I don't think you can deal with challenging behaviour. I think you can only, you can look for triggers and you can deal with triggers. But if you firefight, you'll just be firefighting forever. Whereas I would say I would be looking at doing more of what works, promoting positive behaviour. That's my kind of key.
Yeah, definitely. So would you say, is that the main objective in your work? Or what's the kind of main focus, would you say?
Funny you should say that, because I have got a little mantra for this. A few years ago, I employed some people to do some online work for me. And I had a lady that did Google Analytics, and I'm still not really sure what she did. So we went for coffee, and it was like money going out of my account into her account. And I said, no, I'm not being critical here. I said, but what do you do? And she said, oh, I do more of what works and less of what doesn't. And I said, you're in. That's fine. That works for me. So my job is more of what works and less of what doesn't. So if I'm doing an observation, which is absolutely beyond everything my favorite, you know, and I don't do an observation for an hour, I'll go in and spend a whole day. Right. So if I'm doing an observation in a class or a child or something like that, then what I'm really doing is looking for what's working. I'm looking for what's working, and then you take that and you take that balance and you say, right, let's do more of these things that have worked really well, and actually this stuff here, take it out of the equation. In theory, I've got the easiest job in the world.
Yeah,
you know, but you've just got to look at that. And then I've got one particular head teacher, and it's funny because I'm hearing impaired and I've not got the best eyesight, but she said I'm the best pair of eyes and ears she's got. So either the rest of them are really dreadful, or I'm just using mine in a different way.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, great. And it's really interesting you spend a whole day as well. Unfortunately, I think time and budgets and everything doesn't always allow for that, but it's that bigger picture, isn't it, of the child and everyone else involved. So can you tell me a bit more about dual diagnoses? Because I know we've talked about this before, kind of the combinations of the whole neurodiversity. Because I know you said before that it's really important to not see that kind of potential just autism on its own as to
fit with the it's a minefield, Rebecca. I mean, if I say something is positive, doesn't mean the alternative is negative. Yeah. So I'm going to talk about the private sector, which is where I work. But that doesn't mean I'm being critical of the NHS. But the way it works in my world is, this week, talking to a friend of mine who's a psychotherapist. Now, she will regularly ring me up and say, Andrew, I've got a case here, and I think I need you to take a look at it, because you'll look at the neurodiversity of it. And so, I will work with this child, and then I will go back to my colleague and say, well, I've done what I can here, but I think this is where your work starts. Or I've just referred someone to a clinical psychologist because the issues are not to do with neurodiversity. So that's the first element of it. So there's so many people, but and there needs to be. I think there needs to be the right people for the job. But the second point of that is that we all come into it with our different opinions. And so I can be doing an observation in the classroom, and it might be a child with autism or diagnosis of autism. And I can spend that day in a classroom looking at that child with autism, but I might not see autism. I might see something else. And I mean, that's the benefit of spending the day, I suppose. But if I don't see what I'm told I'm supposed to see, I've got two choices. I deal with what I'm told I'm supposed to see, or I deal with what I really can see. And that seems like the better option to me. So that's the first sort of element of that is you need to really use your eyes and ears and work with what you can see. The second part of that is that a diagnosis, in my vision and what in my experience, is you only get usually one.
Mm.
You know, I know children that one of my own children's got multiple diagnoses. Well, probably a lot of that's because his dad knows what he's looking for and has pushed for that to get it in place. But, you know, not, and again, that's not being critical of any other parents or professionals, but, you know, rarely do these things come alone. I mean, and I know you've seen, there's a Venn diagram that I use all the time, and it's got ADHD in the middle, and it says 31% ADHD, and the other 69% have got something else as well. So if you just worked, you know, but you probably only got the ADHD diagnosis, so if you just work with that ADHD diagnosis, then you're probably missing the fact that there's a 50% chance that that child's dyslexic as well. And that dyslexia is causing him or her frustrations and what have you. And the behaviour might be absolutely nothing to do with the ADHD.
Mm.
It could be to do with the dyslexia. And I think the Venn diagram that I use is so simple. I think there's probably much, much more complex ones.
Yeah, because there's so much overlap with lots of different areas, aren't there? So do you want to just explain for the listeners what neurodiversity is?
I'll let that motorbike go past first. I can hear it in your end. You know what neurodiversity?
Yeah, what is it? Explain what the term means.
Well, neurodiversity, neuro is of the brain. Diversity is differences. So really, we're talking about a different brain. We're talking about people who are usually skilled in other areas and different areas. So when I delivered my TEDx, I used, I think, three case studies. I used a medical consultant who was clearly Asperger's, so clearly Asperger's, you know, but absolutely and totally obsessed with his particular area of medicine. And in that, to me, that's neurodiversity working at its absolute best. Mm. This person had found themselves in a job, in a role that suited them completely. One of the other, you know, and that neurodiversity, would you necessarily, in neurotypicism, the neurotypical person, find somebody that focused on that thing?
Mm.
It's less likely.
Mm-hmm.
And so, similarly, I did some trainings a few years ago now for some visiting architectural students from the Middle East. And these visiting architectural students were all dyslexic. Now, how do you get 100 dyslexic architectural students together? That's a big question. But then if you look at the way a dyslexic person sees something, they're holistic. Mm. So if they're looking at a model of a building or a real building, they're imagining what's around the back. They can't see it. They're not X-Men. But they can imagine what they think might be around the back, what would go. And that's how dyslexia works. That's why you get your B's and D's around the wrong way. But neurodiversity, to me, is all about finding your groove and working to your skills. If the world were a village, all these different people would be doing different things, and they would have different roles. You know, you'd maybe have the ADHD person would be the one that stays awake at night, keeping an eye on things that is safe. You know, minding the animals and stuff like this. And you might have the dyslexic person might be the one that designed the village, and the ADHD, the autistic person or the Asperger person be the one that you know, does all their research into whatever. So neurodiversity to me is about, yes, it's a different brain, but it's using that different brain at its absolute optimum.
Mm.
And, you know, I always say to people, you know, if you get an ADHD person and put them behind the till at Tesco's, yeah? Now, there's nothing wrong with working behind the till at Tesco's, but if you're hyperactive impulsive, there is everything wrong with working behind the till at Tesco's.
Yeah.
But then if you get a neurotypical person or an autistic person and say, right, you're going to do a job like mine where you're traveling to different places on different days, meeting different people, or you're going to go on a stage at a conference and you don't know what questions they're going to ask you, well, the autistic person and probably the neurotypical person isn't going to like that.
Mm.
The ADHD person is going to thrive on that, thrive on that thrill. And so, you know, that's what neurodiversity means to me. But it's very much about meeting those needs, not in a well, we'll have a lovely sensory classroom, yeah, all that sort of stuff as well, but meeting those needs long term and saying, what is this person going to do?
Mm.
What is this person going to do with the rest of their life? And how are we going to look at their presentations and build a career around it?
Yeah, and that's so important, isn't it? Thinking about what we're doing now that might be impacting on the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, I think for listeners, if you are interested in Andrew's TED Talk, it's definitely worth a listen. Was it called Superpowers?
From Disability to Superpowers. If you just go on YouTube and write in Andrew Whitehouse TEDx, it'll come pretty much straight up. It's only 13 minutes long. It stops just as you get bored.
Well timed. Right, yeah. Definitely worth a watch and listen. So I think I just wanted to talk a bit about anxiety, because I had a statistic recently that I was told that 70 to 80% of autistic individuals will experience mental health conditions at some point in their life. So why do you think that's the case? Why are there links with autism and anxiety?
I mean, there's probably a million reasons, right? But off the top of my head, I would say when you have one of these conditions, you become the minority. You become the minority. So, I've got you've asked me that question, and I said there might be a million reasons, and I feel like I've got a million answers for you. So, not in any order, but the first one I want to talk about is society. So society, I was talking about this to my teenage daughter yesterday. Society are frightened of people they don't understand.
Yeah.
So when they are frightened of those people, then frightened people lash out. That's that fight or flight thing. Mm. And so if you've got a sort of person that you don't understand their behaviours in front of you, then you are, as a neurotypical person, you might well be handling this quite badly because of your own lack of understanding.
Mm.
Now, the message going back to that neurodiverse person is, oh my goodness, I just don't fit in anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't fit in with all this thing. I don't fit in with the world. And I think that can cause you a whole lot of anxiety. As an ADHD person myself, that I spent years going, why am I so odd?
Mm.
Actually, you're not odd at all. Mm-hmm. You know, you're a talented person at your job, and you do this and you do that. You're just not the same as those other people.
Yeah.
And so there's a video. Did you ever see that Tim Webb video? It was 11 minutes long. He was quite clear on this, called A is for Autism. It was all animations.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, I loved it. Yeah. I must have used that in training every day for 10 years. And I think I only stopped because the disc got damaged. But for the listeners, track it down. It's on YouTube. It's on Amazon. But A is for Autism. And there's a line in there and where one of those children says, people don't like people who are different.
Mm.
And so that's a huge, huge... massive kind of obstacle to overcome. So that's the first thing. And I know so many children with autism who've been bullied.
Hmm.
You know, who've been bullied, beaten up, had their sandwiches stolen, you know, all that kind of stuff. All the time I hear this stuff. Not just like, you hear a case of this maybe once a fortnight.
Hmm.
So there's that. There was a gentleman I was speaking to, his wife, and I wear hearing aids. And she said, my husband's hearing's going really bad. He's 40 years old. And I said, oh, well, I can advise him on really good hearing aids. And she said, yeah, but he won't wear them because his mates at work will take the mickey out of them.
Mm.
That's just outrageous.
Mm.
It's outrageous. That shouldn't happen.
No.
That really shouldn't happen. And so there's that societal thing, yeah, of And I think the other thing is I'm a big one, passionate about people with neurodiversity finding their groove. The new Ofsted framework's all about this, and I've spoken it when we're still allowed to speak places. I've spoken at 2 Ofsted conferences this year, and the new Ofsted framework is all about following that life journey. If you've got a child who is a gifted drummer or has the potential to be a gifted drummer, let's follow drumming, and this, that, and the other. And I'm hoping that's going to have an impact on neurodiverse people, following their groove. But it can take you years to find that. And I think there's a real temptation for particularly autistic and ADHD people, dyslexic's different again, autistic and ADHD people, to try and fit in.
Mm.
And actually the worst thing you can do is try and fit in.
Mm. Yeah, it's that whole kind of masking, isn't it? And we know that the impact of that, of, obviously we all mask to a degree. You might behave in a certain way in a work meeting with the boss compared to how you are at home on a Friday night, perhaps. But if you're constantly putting that mask on that isn't really you, and like you say, if society, the fact that a young person had said that, people don't like difference, he'd got that message from somewhere at such a young age.
Yeah.
And there's so much work, I think, to be done. It links with all the other kind of areas of diversity and inclusion about teaching children in schools about difference.
It can't be just done,
hoping that the children pick up on it. I think we need much more, explicit teaching, really.
Yeah, I think so. I remember one of my daughters saying to me when she was 5 years old, and I didn't know it was on the TV, but you've maybe not seen it, but there was this Pink Floyd video, Another Brick in the Wall. Yeah. It was about education, and you've got children. It's a real massive social comment. They're coming into a Mensa, and they all got their individual faces, and they all come out at the other end with the same face.
Yeah.
And my 5-year-old daughter said to me, oh, that's because schools want everyone to be the same.
Yeah.
And I thought, if 5 years old, if you're telling me this. Now, that's not across the board with every school, but it happens.
Mm.
So if there's any teachers and professionals, I'm not saying this is you and this is not what you do. I'm saying, but there are scenarios of this, but there are scenarios of this in every element of life. But what the point I'm making is, kids pick up on this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Even at 5 years old, they know what's going on.
Yeah, definitely.
I was watching a video today, it was a comedy video, and this guy was saying about his son, his 4-year-old son, and he was saying he was autistic and he didn't speak apart from the da 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 da. That's all he would say. And he said, and so your natural assumption is to underestimate that person.
Mm.
And he said, actually, this guy is this young person, this 4-year-old's analytical skills were unbelievable. And his manipulative skills as well, unbelievable. And we do miss this, but the kids don't. The kids are way ahead of you and me.
Yeah, it's like, I suppose, conditioning, isn't it, to expect people to fit into a certain box or certain profile. And we don't all, we all take our different paths, I guess. So what do you think the key things are then in sort of school and education settings that people can do to help support an autistic student, whether with well-being or just generally kind of, to cope with the stresses of the day?
I think you have to be introspective. Yeah. You have to say, right, okay, what am I doing that's not working?
Mm-hmm.
What am I doing that's not working? What am I doing that is working? Mm. And I'm a great one. In my training, I talk about make a list. Make a list. 3 things that went well today, 3 things that didn't go well. That's your plan. Immediately, that's your research done, isn't it? Take your 5 minutes at the end of the day to do those things. I think learning walks. I think getting other people to come in and walk around and come into your classroom. If you've got a PPA time, things like that, to get another professional to come in and look at you and say, right, what do you think I did?
Mm.
What do you think I did? Where am I getting it right? I think you hear a lot of people say, oh, such and such, Mrs. Jones, Mrs. Smith, or, you know, Mr. Lawson, they're really good with this child. Fantastic. I'm delighted to hear that. Come on, have a look.
Yeah.
What are they doing? What is it that they're doing? Because you can replicate that. You know, teachers are great actors. They're the most best actors on the planet. So they can replicate that. They can do that thing. So I think there's a certain element of that, you know, using your intuition. I think a lot of us, I mean, I was a teacher for years, and a lot of us, we take stuff personally.
Mm.
I mean, you know, there's a whole lot of in education for inclusion. The whole lot of throwing as much mud at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Mm.
You know, so I would suggest that we, you know, that we have nerves of steel while we go in and try something new that we know might fall flat on our face, because, you know, you got to kiss a lot of frogs to find your prince. Yeah. And so that's, you know, get out there, kiss some frogs, take risks. Yeah. And so my mother said this on the phone last week to me. So, you know, she's an old lady now, but she still comes out with wisdom. And she said to me, she said, don't think what might happen if I do this. What might happen if I don't do it?
Yeah.
Take the risks. Take risks. And there's, I'm vice chair of governors in two schools in Lincoln, and they're part of an academy trust. And both schools have got this huge signage up that says it's a safe place to take risks.
Good.
So take risks.
Yeah. And I think that's relevant to parents as well, because I think parents sometimes have this kind of, they're quite hard on themselves, so they might beat themselves up about, you know, I tried this but it didn't work, but then I see going into school and maybe have an image of school as being this perfect place. And I'll often say, well, actually, even in your, you know, your most specialist schools where staff have lots of different training and experience, there'll still be things that they try that don't work. And, you know, it's we're dealing with people, so you know, it's nothing more complicated really than that. So I think a lot of parents can feel quite overwhelmed by that whole, you know, the whole process really.
Well, during lockdown, I mean, it was funny you said this, and you said, you know, and during lockdown, I can't remember your exact words, Andrew's providing his support
virtually.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, I work with a local group. It's a parent support group called PACT, P-A-A-C-T. We're only based in Lincoln, but it's really, it's a really good little group, and we really do support the parents and professionals that come into the group. And what's interesting about PACT is that when we stopped our workshops for this year, we meet once a month on a Friday morning at a local church hall, and it's coffee, and I do a couple of hours chat. But when we stopped these, I said, this is really bad. I said, because for some people, this is their lifeline. Once a month, this is their big thing. We need to open up the phone lines. So I basically said, any of the parents want to ring up and talk to me about your children, I'm here. Yeah, no cost, no fees, no nothing, just ring me up.
Great.
I've got to say, I don't cost anything unless I have to get off my backside. You know. And so you've got parents ringing me up, and they're ringing me up about things that they're really worried about. And I don't want to undermine people's fears and concerns, but, you know, I find the parent in me. I've got four kids, and I'm there going, you're joking, that's fine. I wouldn't worry about that, you know. And sometimes they just need that.
Yeah.
Sometimes they just need that. You know, I had a conversation, an Instagram conversation. As you know, I've been doing the Instagram live conversations with other professionals. And I had Alexis Powell Howard, the psychotherapist, on. And we must have spent 15 minutes out of the hour, talking about how agitated we've been getting with our kids over lockdown, and how we still moan about the same thing every day. Well, we're the professionals. This is a psychotherapist and a specialist in neurological disorder. You know, having a conversation going drives me nuts. My kids are driving me nuts, you know. And actually, that's really, you know, I mean, she didn't know as much as me because she's only got three. But that's really kind of, accept it, you know. Attachment disorder, for secure attachments in children, you only have to be adequate most of the time. Mm. Adequate most of the time. Yet, you know, we all work towards this kind of utopian vision of parenting.
Yeah.
You know, and you ain't going to get it. And then there's the self-loathing comes in, doesn't it?
Mm. And I guess that's, I mean, some of that is made worse, I think, by social media and things like that, with people comparing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But you've managed to use social media for quite a good use over lockdown, haven't you, really?
I've not been off it. I've been on it all the time. I've been, in fact, it's funny again, because I've been working with my daughter today, and I said to her, I said, you know what? I said, I've not been on social media today. It's just, I feel like I need to be telling people something or sharing, I should say. But it's, I mean, social media, you know, Instagram's the great one, isn't it? Mm. All the beautiful people of Instagram, you know, and I sort of go, well, is your life really like that?
Yeah.
You know, is your life really like that? People say it to me. They go, how is your lovely family? You think I'm so, you know, really, come and spend a weekend with us.
Oh.
And that's kind of, yeah, social media doesn't help in a lot of ways. It creates competition, I think, but it can also be used very effectively. But yeah, parenting, you know, I'm during the lockdown, I mean, the first couple of months when it was really heavy, I mean, my opinions on whether it should be still heavy are mine, but the first couple of months, parents ringing me up and I'm saying, you know, they'll say, I can't get my child to sit at a dinner table with us.
Hmm.
You've got one job, keep that child alive over this period.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it's about perspective and picking your battles, isn't it?
Definitely.
It's about saying, what's the most important thing to my child during a global pandemic? Hmm. Sitting at the dinner table or not catching a potentially fatal disease?
Hmm.
You know, but we don't. We get caught up in it all. We get caught up in the moment. We're at the eye of the storm in the hurricane, aren't we?
Mm.
And we have to be aware that there's more important things. And actually, going back full circle, I think that's where my job comes in. You know, it's a lot easier for an outsider to come in somewhere, to a school, and say, do you know what? And they go, yeah, I never thought about that. And that's all you're doing, because you're not so emotionally attached.
Yeah, definitely. Somebody said that to me recently about, you know, communication with their child. And I said, yeah, but that's because they're not my child. I don't have that same emotional attachment. Like you say, you can look kind of subjectively.
Oh, my goodness me. If you saw the way I spoke to my children, you know, I was out on a bike ride the other night. I was saying this on Instagram yesterday, and one of my kids fell off. And I'm like, get back on that bike, we're in a hurry. No, it's not that I don't care. So yeah, I mean, it is that one degree of separation really does help you. Does help.
So just to kind of sum up, what would your
nearly?
What would be your kind of closing message, I guess, to parents and educators that are working with different children with neurodiversities?
I suppose then we need to really ask, what is our key objective?
Mm.
And a key objective in life is inclusion. And I'm talking about inclusion in every walk of society, you know? And so I think you've got to ask yourself the question, am I including this human being?
Mm-hmm.
Is that human being included by me? And if they're not, what can I do to include that person? And if they are, you know, what can I do even better, I think is got to be the way forward. Now, for that sounds more education based, but actually I think it's school based, it's home based as well. I think even in the home, you can look at your child and you can say, what am I doing to make my child happy? What am I doing to guide my child through? I mean, so many things that we can ask ourselves. Are we pushing our child in education, for example, in the wrong direction? Are we saying, I want my son, my daughter to be a lawyer or a doctor or a you know, when maybe being a lawyer or a doctor, you know, maybe they would rather be a contortionist, or, you know, maybe that's their real skill. I'm being silly, but, you know, it happens. I mean, how many adults leave the world of banking and run off and join the circus or something like that? And so, you know, how much are you supporting their real skills? So how much are you including them? And how much are you empowering them to follow and find their groove?
Yeah, I love that. That should be your, you should have that written on t-shirts or something. Find Your Groove by Andrew
White. Yeah, that would be nice. Yeah, yeah. Somebody online said that. I really like that, Find Your Groove. But
yeah,
I think, I've got personal experience of trying to find my groove. Once you get to that point, I mean, for me, it's professionally. I've got a job I love. I absolutely love. Mm. I've also got a job that I know huge amount of people would hate my job. Mm. You know, they couldn't bear it, you know. And so I ask people sometimes, I say, because one of the things I do to myself is I test myself. Mm. I say, right, we're going to do a conference. I'm speaking at a conference. Just for fun, I won't plan anything.
Oh, gosh.
So once I know, so I can see your face, the listeners can't. And so just for fun, I'll go, right, don't write anything for the conference. Show up, deliver the conference, 45 minutes, and just see what comes out. And it's usually pretty good. And yet I say to people, how do you feel about standing up in front of 1,000 people or 500 people and delivering a script? They say, oh, I couldn't do that. So, okay, how would you feel about doing the same thing for 500 people but not having a script? Oh, my goodness me, no, that would be just dreadful. Yeah, well, that's the point, isn't it? Because what we're doing, we're reflecting our own needs on other people, you know, and we do this with children all the time. And actually what we should say is, okay, back to that, what happens if you don't? Let them take that risk. Kevin Roberts, who's a good friend of mine, is an American ADHD specialist, wrote a book called Movers, Dreamers and Risk Takers. Mm. It's about ADHD. And I just, you know what, I've got to confess, I've read all his books apart from that one. But the title is fantastic, isn't it? Movers, Dreamers and Risk Takers. What are you doing for your movers, your dreamers and your risk takers?
Yeah, that's definitely. And I think it's, and a big part of education is that whole reflective practice. Reflecting on what you're doing, why you're doing it. And like you say, whose needs are we meeting? Because sometimes we're not actually, it's not about the child's needs. You know, it's, we're doing this process because we've always done it maybe, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do for that child perhaps.
Yeah, I agree. And I think so, you know, it's about changing the dialogue. It really is about changing the dialogue. Mm. And I think certainly the gap between from when I was a child to now has just, education has come on so much. Mm. You know, parenting has come on so much. I was watching a YouTube video interview with Little Richard, the rock and roll singer. Mm-hmm. So he just died recently, and he was supposed to be one of the pioneers of rock and roll. And he was one of 9 children, and he came from Macon, Georgia, very poor family. Mm. And he said his father described him as a disappointment. Wow. And this man went on to be one of the most loved men in popular music, you know. And he was describing this as at the age of about 70, and I was watching this interview, and he's crying still at the age of like 70. My father said I was a disappointment, you know. Actually, he found his groove. Mm. He found his groove, and actually, if we could all do something like that, that'd be great.
Definitely. Wow, thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you.
Yeah. It's, I mean, as always, pearls of wisdom from you, and always a pleasure. So to our listeners, if you want to find out a bit more about Andrew and the work he does, you can visit www.andrewwhitehouse.co.uk. He's got his own website. And also Andrew WSCN on all the things. You're on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram?
I'm on, so, okay. So it's got a bit complicated. So Andrew W, You know, like when your mum wrote your name in your cardigan, Andrew W-S-E-N, that's Twitter and Instagram. You can find everything from there. It'll lead you into, I'm on all the social medias, but you can link on from there. www.andrewwhitehouse.co.uk is a new website that's just for online digital pre-recorded workshops. And but my main website is peoplefirsteducation.com.
Lovely.
Sorry about all that.
That's okay. I'm sure everyone will keep them all on their toes, won't we?
Thank you so much for having me, Rebecca.
Thank you for joining us. And yeah, definitely take a look at all of Andrew's works. He's done some great stuff. So thank you again.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed hearing from Andrew with his many pearls of wisdom. One of the reasons why I really respect him and get on so well with him is because we share that ethos for inclusion, and I don't think he could have explained that any better today. Please do check out our next episode, or for more information, visit www.cognos.org.uk.